Stonehenge is one of the most iconic and mysterious sites from the ancient world that's still with us today. And this year, it's celebrating its 100th anniversary as a publicly owned property. Using new technology, researchers are making more discoveries about what rituals took place there and what the stones can tell us about the people who built it. Dave Potraz is one of WPR's network announcers and has been studying the history of the site for years. He's currently on vacation in England, and he talked with us earlier today live from Stonehenge. So tell us where you are and what you're seeing.
Well, I am, if you'll pardon the pun, just a stone's throw away from perhaps the most famous of ancient monuments in the world. And while some who come and visit here see it as just a pile of rocks, for many, many others, including me, it is so much more. Stonehenge lies in the midst of a rich archaeological landscape, contains major ancient earthworks and a myriad of other traces of prehistoric civilization from the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, and all the way into the Iron Age.
Wow. Well, as you said, some people, I would like to think just a few, think of it as a big pile of rocks, but the rocks are pretty amazing. And those huge stones you told us are called sarsens. And that's, I think, what people picture. But there are also smaller stones at the site, and they're called bluestones. Tell us what we can learn from those bluestones.
Yes, that's right. The sarsens, of course, are what we think of when we think of Stonehenge. But within the sarsen circle, if you will, there are also a number of these bluestones, and more archaeologists and researchers are coming to realize that it may be perhaps the bluestones that carry the most ancient meaning, if you will, from the very beginning of the Stonehenge site itself.
So what do we know about the people who built Stonehenge?
Well, it's important to understand, of course, that Stonehenge is not just one monument built as a single event. It's actually many monuments constructed over more than 1,000 years.
Hmm.
And as such, it's been many things to many people, separated by time, and that's where the bluestones come in. It's one of the most intriguing enigmas about Stonehenge. The fact that the great mystery now is how in the world did they get here? You know, were they dragged, carried over land, keeping in mind that this was before wheeled transportation. Maybe they were brought by sea around the southern coast of Britain. Some say they might have been brought by glaciers. But here's the fascinating part. Here's the really fascinating part. Right now, archaeologists are testing the hypothesis that the bluestones may well have been derived from a pre-existing stone circle or other monument in the nearby Wales, so nearby the Welsh quarries that they were extracted from.
Hmm.
And they were uprooted and somehow transported more than 100 miles away. And this is where the people of Stonehenge come in. They're analyzing 5,000-year-old cremated human bones excavated here at Stonehenge, and they appear to have been buried adjacent to those possibly re-erected bluestones, moved from Wales, moved to the Stonehenge site, re-erected, and these bones have been found in the pits that held those stones. Now, what's really interesting is that as many as one-third of those buried here have been analyzed and are chemically consistent with people living 5,000 years ago in Western Britain, a region that includes Wales and the home of, you guessed it, the known source of the Stonehenge bluestone. So there's a real connection being drawn between that part of the country and right here in Wessex.
Wow, that really is fascinating. And what do we know about why Stonehenge is in the shape and arrangement that it is? Because it certainly seems very significant how those stones were placed.
Yeah, here's my take on that. Again, getting back to this idea that the bluestones may have been derived from a structure in Wales and then disassembled, carried piece by piece. There's about 80 stones or so that are the bluestones, carried here and set up within this circle of earthwork that is the henge part of Stonehenge. And then I'm thinking, from what I've read and from what I've absorbed, that it might have been perhaps another version of the bluestone monument that was maybe further enhanced, if you will, or honored or memorialized by the addition of the much larger Sarsen stones, which occur naturally within this region, within about 20 miles away. So basically, they took a pre-existing stone circle and made it even more extravagant, even more elaborate, using local material and improved techniques.
Interesting. So the smaller stones might actually be the more significant stones, it sounds like.
That's what it's becoming to be understood more and more.
Dave Potraz is one of WPR's network announcers. You probably hear his voice many times a day. And he is also our resident expert on British archaeology, joining us from vacation at Stonehenge. And Dave, when you brought this idea to us, one of the things that just really struck me was you said that this year marks the 100th anniversary, many things about Stonehenge, we talk about thousands, but the 100th anniversary of Stonehenge becoming a publicly owned property. And before that, it was in private hands. So who gave Stonehenge to the British people?
It was purchased in 1915, I believe, by a local barrister, Cecil Chubb, and his wife, Mary. They bought it in 1915 from the previous owners, the Antrobus family. And the legend is that Mr. Chubb attended an auction with the intent of purchasing a set of dining room chairs.
And he came home with Stonehenge?
Yeah, came home with Stonehenge. Can you imagine? And then in 1918 it was, 100 years ago, that he gifted the land of Stonehenge to the English people. And now English Heritage is the steward of the property.
Well, Stonehenge is certainly a big attraction, but there are other important ritual sites in the area you're visiting, Dave, and one of them is Durrington Walls. Tell us about what we have learned about ancient feasting from that site.
This is, again, very interesting and very recent excavations and research has been done on this. What archaeologists have recently discovered is that the area of Durrington Walls, which includes, I think you may have heard of Woodhenge, that's a wooden circle that kind of mimics the stone circle, that this was also connected to the River Avon by a short avenue, which means that the entire site took on a two-part ritual ceremonial significance. They're thinking now that one represented a place of the living, the wood, the other a place of the ancestors, the dead, the stone. And here's the picture that they're painting. They would have massive feasts, massive festivities. We'd begin at the site at Durrington Walls. Abundant evidence has been found of extravagant feasting. And then the celebrants would commence down a processional route to the River Avon, all the way along, about 3 or 4 miles along the River Avon, before making their way up to the long avenue to Stonehenge. And that site, of course, had already been used as a cemetery for 500 or 600 years. And they believe that their arrival was, we all hear of the summer solstice, of people celebrating the sun rising over Stonehenge and that axial alignment. But they're thinking now that the more significant might have been the winter solstice, the shorter day of the year. And they have evidence of that from the feasting remains that they have found at the area of Durrington Walls, massive middens, basically garbage pits of food waste. And they've been able to determine from the bone analysis from the animals that they were eating, was mainly pigs and beef, cattle, that they were culled in the fall so that they were eaten, possibly barbecued, the whole animal barbecued, and they were consumed in the fall. So that they believe that this processional was more aligned with the idea of the ending of the season, of the ending of the year. And so it was winter that the celebrants would participate in this long trip to Stonehenge. When they arrived, they would be just seeing the sun setting behind Stonehenge on the other side. You can see it clearly through the stones.
Wow. Well, Dave, as we wrap up briefly, you know, you told us that this is your third trip to Stonehenge. You've learned a lot about it over the years. What got you so interested in the history there?
Well, I'd sum it up in two words, lifelong learning. And, you know, that would sound gratuitous because that's what we're all about at public radio. But in this case, it's absolutely true. I visited here for the first time in the 1980s, had no idea what I was looking at. Then fast forward about 30 years, in 2008, I was actually listening to the Kathleen Dunn Show, and she had a British archaeologist who proceeded to describe all of the fascinating new research and all the field excavations that were going on here. So if lifelong learning is the goal, well, then at least for me, the Stonehenge landscape and beyond is a worthy candidate for study. You know, the terrific wealth of knowledge already gained here is only exceeded by really the treasure that's still hidden here and really waiting to be revealed. And I don't know if the term has been coined yet, so I'll do it. I think we're approaching what would you call a golden age of archaeology. There are so many methods now that were not available 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. Archaeologists and researchers can find so much more about the people that lived here 5,000 years ago.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for taking time out of your vacation to share your passion with us, and have a great rest of your trip.
Thank you, Judith. Happy to do so.
Dave Potrez is one of WPR's announcers, and he talked with us earlier today live from Stonehenge about the new discoveries being made at one of the world's most famous sites.